Welcome to Talk Town. Today's special guest is Paralympian Tim Maloney. Tim, as a junior, held the world record for 800 metres. He then went on to the Atlanta Olympics to represent Australia in basketball, where they won the gold medal. This is the first time Australia had ever won a gold medal in basketball. These are the moments that make up Tim's life. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Rick.
Can you talk about your earliest memory?
Well, I'm glad you prepped me for this the other day, because I was trying to think of my earliest memory. What I remember is my legs in full plaster, either being in a hospital environment or getting around on my belly on like a homemade skateboard thing, running over my thumbs, which didn't tickle. My earliest memory is, sort of having limited mobility.
Can you remember some things that you did like prior to going to school or kindergarten, things that just come up?
Well, I'll start early. My disability, I had a tumour on my spine when I was 9 months old. So I've always had this background of doctors, hospitals, medical appointments, physio. That took up a lot of time. So, their memories, but outside of that, there would be family things, like visiting my grandmother, pretty regular. Yeah, but most of the time it was really, really hospitals and stuff, because I was going through lots of surgery, lots of corrective surgery. Some worked, some didn't.
Do you remember that being painful, or is it just a memory of going and...
Look, it's still painful. The disability doesn't stop. It continues. So, I remember disliking physiotherapy the most, with the stretching of muscle groups that really didn't want to stretch a whole lot, because I was a bit, contorted, twisted in actual body shape, lordosis, scoliosis, very tight ligaments and tendons. So I wouldn't lie flat in bed. There was always a kink and a twist in there all over the place. So they were trying to iron me out, get me as flat as possible. And I remember that being pretty young.
Did you go to a normal kindergarten or preschool? With general population, or do you remember that being something different?
Well, I reckon I was really lucky, because I went to regular schooling all the way through. I went to the local kindergarten, with one of mum's best friends didn't live far away, so, her kids and me, we all went to the same kindergarten. And then I went to McGill Primary School, and then I ended up going to Morialta High School. So it was mainstream all the way through.
Did you excel academically, or did you...
Heck no.
You struggled through school, or just had too much fun?
My favourite time of school was lunch and recess, and then, of course, going home. No, I'm not an academic person as such. I'm very tactile, very practical. I'm not a good book learner, which that was the method, back then.
Did you have any sort of ability that you discovered in primary school with physical education or sport with you in your chair at that stage?
Well, in primary school, I wasn't actually using my wheelchair a whole lot. I was still ambulant on two legs with leg braces and walking sticks. So I enjoyed sport. I enjoyed being involved in sport, but being the one out of 100 that had the least amount of mobility, that, became a bit tricky. And the old trick of, here, you score the runs, you keep score on the sideline, which unfortunately, again, was, the education limits of the time. I ended up doing that sort of stuff.
So the teacher struggled to work out how to incorporate you into what was going on.
Yeah, in hindsight, I reckon they were having problems with it. I was trying to educate people out otherwise nowadays, but back then it was a bit different. A couple of good things I did have in my corner was I had a couple of uncles who worked for the education department. So when I was in that primary school age, Things like the earth ball and the parachute and all those other fun things, which we now take for granted, were being incorporated, and all the life in it was happening, you know, brand new campaign, you know, getting kids active, getting them involved. So I had access to that stuff away from school. So I didn't get it there, but I got it. I got it, you know, birthday parties and weekends and that sort of stuff. So I was exposed at that sort of time, which was awesome.
Through the primary school and then sort of moving on to high school, same thing. How did sport change for you in high school? Or did it become something that you could be more involved with then?
Well, for me, sport happened accidentally. There was an ad in the paper for a school holiday program, which was being run by Wheelchair Sports South Australia, now Disability Recreation and Sport. And they were doing a holiday program, and my parents looking for, well, my mum looking for alternative things and options and that sort of stuff. She took me along. I jumped in a wheelchair, learned some wheelchair skills, started playing some games, and from there found out I had some natural ability just athletically.
And were those games based upon anything at that stage?
Sure, they're based upon Red Rover and basketball and Stuck in the Mud, mm-hmm. and, you know, all those fun things that you want to do when you're, you know, 10, 11, 12.
So it was just play, but using a wheelchair.
Sure. I mean, it was the same games that you would find in any phys ed handbook, but everybody was in a wheelchair, varying degrees of people with disability. And it was, you know, that fun method of, if you play a game, you'll enjoy it, but you also develop all the skills that come with it, and the health benefits and the social benefits.
How was your social life in high school? How did you sort of manage that? Was it, you're a pretty outgoing person, so did that just click, you were Tim, so that was you at high school and kids accepted that? Or was it a bit of a struggle with friendships and that sort of lifestyle through the school?
Well, I was really lucky. In 1981, they held the first National Junior Games. So I was 13. And I went along and, you know, met kids from all around the country. And, you know, we hung out and, you know, we competed against each other. And we had a whole lot of social time together, which was great. And I guess that put me in a place of what I understood, that, you know, I was pretty good at this thing, you know, called athletics, and, you know, loved the basketball and pretty much tried everything under the sun, from archery, table tennis, swimming, you know, the works. If you put it out in front of me, I'd give it a red hot go. So that's what I took into high school. And I'd been picked up, you know, at a junior level to start training athletics. So that was my social group. My social group was more away from school than in school. Mm-hmm. There were people from school that, you know, we hung out with, but then school finished and it was, okay, you're going to go to this training, or you're going to do, you know, going to play some basketball or whatever it happened to be. So in between attempting to do my homework and mum telling me off for not doing my homework, yeah, it was sort of that athletic sort of influence.
So who was your first athletics coach for wheelchair racing? So where did that, your initial starting point?
Well, the process that was in place when I first started, a gentleman by the name of Ian Wardrop and his wife Marilyn, they were heavily involved with the juniors of wheelchair sport. So they were my first coaches in athletics, track and field, and of all things. And then we were introduced to other people who had significant roles in the state and actually nationally within the wheelchair sport area. So I was lucky. I had senior athletes, you know, as role models and people that were representing Australia and, you know, competing, you know, multi-sport international, you know, during the day they'd be racing track and, you know, at night they'd be playing basketball. So really full schedules. So, you know, these were the people that, you know, I got to see and train with and be with. So that was sort of the initiation into it all, was sort of being brought through with these role models and a couple of early coaches.
Around that time, you then moved on to John Daly's squad and Daly's Demons. So it was a
the boss JD.
so he had a very elite squad. And walking into that squad, it was hard.
Walking.
Well, you always called it running.
Yeah,
back in the day as well.
You keep wanting to put hurdles in front of me, but anyway, that's a whole other story.
But you came out to that squad and joined in, and it was pretty cool. So can you just talk about that, coming out to that squad and the people that you had to deal with?
Being in JD's squad was awesome. It was, for me, the first time I had a full integration of people I'd train with. It didn't matter if you had a disability, didn't have a disability, you were super elite, or, you know, trying to get there. We had a really varied group of people. You know, I believe my family approached JD to see if he would coach, and he graciously accepted, and, you know, put together training programs that I'd never had before, because we're dealing with volunteers and amateurs. I mean, we're all amateur at that stage, but sort of more constructed programs with specific goals and outcomes, versus, oh, this is the sort of stuff we should try and do, which is where I was coming from, which I had no regrets about, because, you know, without that, I wouldn't have got to, you know, that level of being recognized as, you know, an elite level, you know, junior athlete.
The wheelchairs through that period went through an amazing transformation. Yeah. From the first chair I remember you training in, which just looked like a normal wheelchair.
Yeah.
It probably had a few modifications, but it was pretty basic stuff, to the sort of end of your career. But if you just talk a little bit about those early wheelchairs.
Sure. Okay, if you can imagine a stereotypical hospital type wheelchair made of metal tubing that was chromed with a sort of vinyl seat, okay, well, that was your base model, and then you got Haxel, and you cut most of the backrest off, and you cut the brakes off, and you cut off this piece and that piece and substituted it with other bits and pieces to reduce some of the weight, and, you know, weld bits on to make it, you know, sort of perform a little bit better. Everything was in the backyard, and that's where you started. You know, you started from stuff that was made in the backyard. You couldn't purchase things. You know, they were just sort of opening doors in America and Europe, but we were still building everything ourselves. So, you know, sometimes they were made of alloy, sometimes they were made of mild steel, you know, canvas for seating slings, and, you know, using tennis grip wrap, you know, on the push rims, you know, with a smaller diameter push rim to the wheel, so you could, you know, like a gearing system, you know, getting those bits and pieces and then putting them together and making them run true, you know, looking at the toe in, toe out, like you would on a car, except, you know, we're doing it with four wheels, trying to link the two front wheels together so you didn't get speed wobbles and end up in a garden somewhere, or, you know, that sort of accident, which, you know, happened back then because we're developing. You know, unlike today, you've got the professionally built chairs that are around, you know, from, you know, titanium, chrome moly, you know, carbon fiber and whatever else they're using nowadays, and I'm really out of touch with the modern athletics gear, but I just know they're using some really flash gear, and they would weigh, you know, I'd be lucky if they weighed 10% of what mine did, you know, back in the day. So
yeah, I remember
huge changes.
I remember you doing it, I think it was one of your first City Bay fun runs, and I ran with you, and you had the crappiest chair. It was nothing like the supersonic spaceships they're using these days, but you still did it, and you had four wheels, and you went the whole way,
yeah.
And you still did a pretty bloody incredible time.
Oh, it's because I'm awesome.
apart from that. But but if you had one of the super duper chairs that you're on now, you would have just been a rocket. Like, because it was just so, I could see you going down the hills, coming down Keswick Hill there with your front wheels were wobbling, and it was, you still went faster than I could run down the damn thing, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to fall off.
Yeah, watch out anybody in front of me. I was not exactly in control, but I was having lots of fun. But I mean, that's what we were doing. That's where we were in the processes of the evolution of design. And every year somebody would come up with something newer, either in America or Europe, you know, and that would influence would come through. Or, you know, maybe it was something that we were doing here in Australia that took off around the world. So you sort of had to keep watching and, you know, having conversations with people and taking photographs or looking at photographs and going, oh, what's that? How does that work? And, you know, if you went too minimal, you know, you'd get too much flex. So you needed a certain amount of rigidity so you can keep that toe in and that perfect run and, you know, trying to find better bearings, you know, so you'd have a better roll, less rolling resistance. And then the size of the wheels change and how many wheels there were and where the wheels were located. And we're talking things that could be moved in like centimeter increments or, you know, decimal points of a millimeter that would make, you know, a chalk and cheese difference to how a chair ran.
And there's also wear and tear on your hands. Oh, and yeah, that technology changing, how you to wear gloves. I think you started off wearing basically golf gloves when you first came out.
It was probably
from the golf pro shop, and then it became these steel-plated thumbs and tape. And
yeah, I mean, I remember first of all trying doing this stuff, and it was probably just tape on fingers. You know, it wasn't even as elaborate as flash golf gloves. And then we evolved and ended up using diving gloves, which were sort of a wool mesh glove with rubber lines like crisscrossing. So I guess if you were grabbing abalone and stuff, you know, you wouldn't be cutting your hands, but that was a bit of padding. And then I would supplement that with tape, and it would look like I've got like really badly infected fingers, because it was these really big swollen fingers, again using that tennis grip on the push rim and on the gloves. You know, you spend hours working on them, getting the right shape and the right flex and just the right places, and you'd still end up putting tape on your fingers, and you know, to protect them on the inside. But that was the wear and tear.
You're from that sort of training sessions you were doing and really moving into an elite program.
Yeah.
You then qualified for probably your first Australian team to start traveling. So if you want to just talk about making your first Australian team, I think you went to four world juniors and went once before as well.
Well, my first ever international was in 81. First ever world junior games in England. You know, I was 13. You know, I'd been at the national championships here in Adelaide, the first junior national championships here. Yeah, it was selected. They lied about my age because I was too young. You had to be 14 to go, but they took me as a 13-year-old. I think there was another one that was 13 as well. So we went away. I came away with some jewellery. You know, as a 13-year-old kid, I won the slalom, so the obstacle course, which was done on the track. So that was stop, start, spin, turn, manoeuvre, not knock over cones or any of that sort of stuff. So I won that, which was awesome, surprising but awesome. And then picked up some other bits and pieces, because you were swimming, you were doing athletics, you were doing basketball, you were throwing discus, you know, you were doing everything because you're 13 and a kid and you could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not like today where you seem to have to specialize a lot earlier. You know, it was very much, okay, you're not doing anything this morning, you're going to go do this, and you're going to go do that, and you're going to, you know, because we only sent a small team, you know, so it was just one of those things that you just had a red hot go at everything.
So coming back from that first international experience, then it was sort of, I think you moved more into...
Coming back was a nightmare. I don't know if you knew this, but Tullamarine Airport, we're in the elevator, like, we'd had our medals around our neck, and my medal, one of them came off the ribbon. and fell very neatly straight down between the gap between the elevator floor and the elevator door, straight down the bottom of the elevator well. 13. Oh my God, my medal's gone. I'm never going to see it again. End of the world. Anyway, someone went into the bottom of that elevator shaft and got it out for me, and I did get it back. So, you know, first ever international medals, and you've lost one down at an elevator well. It's like, oops, my bad.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, that was on the way home.
A bit stressful. Like,
yeah, but then again, I was 13, so I was like, ah, well, what are you going to do, you know?
So returning back to Adelaide, international experience, then your concentration became more on around the 800 metres.
Yeah, the focus was definitely middle distance.
Yeah, and to sort of push a really good quality time, which yeah. did start happening. So I just want to talk through some of those training sessions you might have done.
Those training sessions.
And we did some of them with you, which was pretty incredible back then. I don't think athletes these days keep up with wheelchair guys because they're too quick. Like the wheelchairs are so amazing.
Depends on the distance.
Yeah, but we did reps together, which was quite amazing. You know, you were doing it with track athletes. You were training with 800, 1500, and 5000 meter track athletes, and just blending in with the training.
And that was the best part. It was pure integration. You know, like we'd all get there. We'd all, you know, do our stretches, and we'd warm up, and we'd have the program that JD had set out the squad. You know, and it wasn't any different. You know, I was using a wheelchair, you were using spikes. I mean, it didn't make any difference. There were, you know, at that time, with wheelchair technology and training techniques and pushing techniques versus running, and we were able to blend in together, and it was just great, because you weren't training by yourself all the time. You had people. It became social.
Which made it really enjoyable. Yeah.
You know, shared stories. I mean, we had some elite people who'd come home from events, and you know, they'd tell us stories, and we'd be like, you know, eyes wide open, you know, jaws, you know, on the ground, going ooh ah, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it was that shared experience, which was just fantastic.
It's invaluable, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think growing up with you through that, you didn't realise how amazing it was until you get older and think back and sort of read about each other and think, oh my God, look, we had a lot of people in that squad that were travelling overseas regularly.
Yeah.
We had people, JD was always on planes, travelling with someone somewhere. The Olympians, Commonwealth Games athletes, just so many people, always on the move.
He was such an elite coach.
Mm.
And we were so lucky to have him in our backyard and then have access to him. JD got me to a level where in 1985, I went to the Australia Day Games, and in a mixed classification race. So we had various types of disability, you know, so the different classification groups all racing at the one event. So they had the best in Australia at that stage. And at the end of the 800 metres, the team manager sort of came running up to me and said, you know what you've done? I'm like, oh, I'm in the poo again. What did I do this time? Being a rat bag at heart. And he said, no, we're submitting this time for a world record, which sort of blew me away. I mean, I thought I was doing okay, but I didn't realise I was being that quick. And that was, I mean, yes, I did it, but I wouldn't have done it without JD and the squad. Because without that motivation and people to chase and that social happiness of being in that group, you know, when some stories were, you know, bigger than Ben Hur, and others were, you know, on the money. But I mean, that was just the environment. It was all fun, and that made the training easy. Even though you'd go home and, you know, you've got achy hands, or I'm sure you had knees and ankles or feet that were telling you rude words, you'd get home at night. But you know, that and JD's programs took me to, you know, a world record. So I don't think there's words that can describe how much I appreciate him and what he's done for me.
I think a lot of people say track and field is a lonely sport, but it really does come down to a squad, and it really does, you're putting that squad together and people working together, because everyone helps everyone get those rewards.
Yeah.
And in that squad particularly, it was infectious. People just wanted to win, and people wanted to run the best times of their lives.
There was a crazy amount of passion in that group.
Mm.
I mean, we had Olympians, we had Commonwealth Games, we had Paralympians, you know, we had like all these people all grouped together, and you know, someone would get back, you know, and like they'd show whatever jewelry they got, you know, from that trip, and that was the next spur for the rest of the people in that group, and then someone else had come home and you'd see what they brought back, and then that would be another spur, and so on and so forth. And you know, there were just all these people coming back from, you know, national meets, club meets, you know, internationals, with all these things going on. You know, I mean, I remember Glenys coming home, Glenys Nunn coming home from LA in '84, you know, and she's come home with the heptathlon gold medal, and that, you know, that blew our minds. I mean, it blew my mind. You know, that one of us from Adelaide, this little group of people, had just gone away and beat everybody in the world at that level. You know, so again, you know, it's another spur, you know, keep going.
So with the World Juniors, you went back again to win a gold?
No, they only went to one World Junior. They weren't run.
It wasn't structured like it is
it
now,
was,
was
no,
it?
No, it's not. It wasn't structured at all. It was put together. And we did it, and we took a team, but then there was like big gaps. I don't even know if there was a second, you know, from that point on. And I don't even know what's run nowadays. I know what there is for basketball. Mm. There's under 25 for women, and there's under 23 for men. And then it's just open men and open women after that. But I don't know what's in place with the athletics anymore. I don't know what steps or pathways are actually in place.
Yeah, it's a lot more rigid, I think, with the states and nationals every year, and they're integrated as well. Like okay. School athletics, you travel with the team.
Yeah,
so you'd be,
I remember
just
doing Pacific school games, yeah, and that sort of stuff. So
yeah, so that's pretty well the same system, but it's more integrated than it has been. So from athletics, you had a world record.
Yeah, went to a couple of world championships.
And how was that? Can you talk about that sort of excitement of going to one of those massive international meets?
Oh, it was so cool. I mean, we went to Stoke Mandeville, which, if you've done any research, Stoke Mandeville was one of the, if not the first place, they were using sport as therapy for people.
There's a Netflix movie about it.
Is
about
there?
That. Place that set it up, and the man, the Jedi that set it up during
Ludwig,
the end of the Second World War.
Sir Ludwig Guttmann.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's actually,
Papa,
it's on Netflix.
Papa Guttmann.
Yeah. It's just come out on Netflix.
Okay. Well, so we were going to the home of, you know, of what is now Paralympic sport, and, you know, all these people from all over, multi-sport, you know, again, swimming, you know, basketball, track, field, archery, you know, all these sports being represented. And that environment, that whole big Australian team environment, you know, and everybody going off and doing, you know, their events and coming back, and you know, that was really cool. I mean, I didn't have, you know, a huge program. I had the middle distance events, and that was it, which is big enough, but I remember in my favourite event, I went out and being inexperienced and only racing in Australia, I got encouraged, let's say, into the middle of the track, you know, pulling grass out of my teeth as I did a nice little barrel roll from some of the other competitors just basically squeezing me out, and hit the rail on the inside and lost it and ended up in the middle. But nothing was seen as you know, my point of view, as I was squeezed out. They just said it was my error. So move on, next event. But yeah, that was my welcome. You know, this 17-year-old kid with the world record, I guess it was like, well, we'll teach him. Hypothetically, I don't actually know what was going through their heads, but that's what I believe.
The travel, difficult for you at that stage to move around the world, or do you find it all pretty cruisy?
Look, world travel is always hard because you've got to get in a plane, and planes are not accessible, and then you're traveling with a huge group, and then the bathrooms, you know, if you've been in a plane, you know how small they are, and then you've got to get from your seat to the bathroom, and you know, you're traveling basically 24 hours, majority of it, you know, in a plane. You're compressed, you sort of can't get up and walk around, so you're basically, you know, plonked in that spot for the bulk of the time. And these are back in the days with the, if you're lucky, it had a single screen for like a couple of movies, you know, not like the options that you have today. And you know, if you've got someone tall in front of you and you can't see the screen, oh well, bad luck, you know. just they were long, you know. You'd play cards and other bits and pieces, and you'd look for alternative things to do, but you know, just access on the plane was the hard. And then, you know, we're lucky in Adelaide, our accessibility, you know, street wise you know, ramps and car parking and all that sort of stuff. Well, you go to Europe, you know, the place is fairly old, you know, and there's steps everywhere. It's not like they're going to say, hang on, we're just going to, you know, destroy the front of St. Paul's Cathedral in London and go, we just got to put in a ramp. Yeah, they get sort of a bit antsy of that heritage, you know, stuff that's, you know, multi-100-year-old, you know, situations or older. So access from that point of view was always tricky.
What was the sort of village life, the athletes' village life, like on those trips?
Ex-World War II Nissen huts. You know, they were like the half dome things you see on the old World War II movies, you know, at the airdromes. You know, you see them, like they're like a half round thing. We had those to stay in. If you're lucky, you got to stay in the new Flash building. So it was interesting going from your own private world into this like shared space, you know, into this like hospital ward type, you know, 20 beds, 30 beds in a ward, you know, and you're all sleeping there together, you know, and all the guys. So you got your field events guys who are generally pretty big units and got the best snore you've ever heard, you know, to, you know, me being 17, you know, looking around, you know, almost trying to hide in a suitcase, like, what the heck is going on here? But it had its own charm in its own way, you know. We were able to play the occasional prank. I remember one gentleman was snoring very loud one night, but because they were all hospital beds, they're all on wheels, so he ended up out in the foyer. We didn't take his wheelchair because we didn't want him to come back in, so we just left him there overnight. He woke up, was wondering what was going on, and hooting and hollering, and we're like, oh, he can't get to us, we're okay for a while yet.
So it was real trailblazing, wasn't it? That story, I mean, that is trailblazing. We had dreams of Australian teams going away and nice accommodation and all that sort of thing, but you're really trailblazing. It's very, very unusual to hear that sort of story these days. You know, the kids have really looked after and,
and
spoiled.
I mean, if you got a twin share room, you were like, this is heaven. You know, like, oh my gosh, you got like all of this stuff, you know. What, there's a fridge in the room as well? Outstanding, you know. And it was, but that's what it was. I mean, I remember at a basketball tournament, the only accommodation we had was up two flights of stairs for a wheelchair basketball team. So they had the local army camped at the bottom. So anytime anybody wanted to get in or out, they'd send 2, 3, 4 blokes up, pick you up, walk you up and down the stairs. And that's what we were for a week in a tournament. You know, for those at home, I'm just shaking my head. that was just, you know, that was some of the stuff that we had to do. So now it's very different, you know, very, very different.
Just a little story to that. On one of the other stories we've done with Curtis Marshall, talking about the Rio Olympics, so we're really jumping forward.
Mm-hmm.
He was training in the rain, and he had 20 blokes on the runway with mops and foam things. So every time he wanted to do a run, they'd mop it and take the water away to clear it, just to show the difference in time. Just so he was the only person training, and these blokes would mop it up, dry it out perfectly while it was still pouring. He'd do his run, and they just kept it dry for the whole training.
I'm still shaking my head. We never had that.
You had the guys carrying you up the stairs. So.
Yeah, with the worry that we'd, you know, one bad grip and we're all tumbling down the bottom. You know, sometimes it's good to be a passenger, but not like that. Pretty sketchy, but anyway. But I mean, I remember training in the rain and you got wet. It's just what it was. You know, you got home and you're shaking and shivering, and, you know, you'd go jump in the hot shower and try and get warm.
Did I remember you coming back from those trips and you made some met a lot of the at that stage. Canada had a pretty awesome crew that were world.
Canada had a really good program very early in adaptability and inclusion, which was outstanding. So you know they were people that I certainly looked up to, you know, as programs went.
And they were very elite fit athletes, and you'd come back to Adelaide raving about these mean machines that you compared against.
Oh, the units. Oh, my goodness. There was some, you know, there were just some really big units. I mean, they had a thrower, and I saw a photograph of this guy sitting in his wheelchair, and he was built like a tank, right? He was huge. And this photo of, I think his name was Jacques, French-Canadian, and he was doing, you know, the double bicep pump, you know, display, but he had a girl sitting on each bicep, you know, so he's sitting in his chair and he's got what I can only imagine is a cheerleader sitting one on each arm, you know, and straight out from his shoulders, you know, on these massive biceps. And it's like, yes, that's a little bit intimidating, but you know, so, that's what you try and got away with, I guess.
So from the athletics, then there's a progression where you've discovered, well, I think you always knew about it. Basketball.
I love basketball.
Yeah, you've always loved basketball. So then there's this progression as a world junior champion in the sport, a world record holder in 800 metres. Then you move into the wheelchair sport of basketball. Do you just want to talk about that transition, just from what flipped you over to start with? Was it the team aspect? Just run through what happened with you.
All the time I was racing, I always played basketball as well, be it even at a local competition level. And then when national titles came around, I'd play either B grade, or when I finally got big enough and strong enough and actually had some skill, I, you know, graduated to A grade. And when I got to a level where I was starting to get noticed as a player, I made the call. After 86, I said, okay, I finished with athletics. I just want to focus on basketball. And people and the organisers within the athletic structure were like horrified. What are you doing? You've got buckets of talent. You know, why are you leaving? And I said, well, I love this better. I love it more. So for me, it was a really easy decision. I mean, it took time to, you know, leave one and, you know, then all my training that I was doing from an athletics point of view, you know, push that off to the side and replaced it with basketball specific stuff. And, you know, it took some time, but I really wanted to go to Seoul in 88, but I didn't make the team for basketball, even though I probably could have for athletics, but I chose not to. And that really hurt. You know, I thought I was having a red hot go because I'd played really well. I played better than some of the team that they took, you know, and I thought I had a right to go. So I got pretty grumpy about the whole deal and said, oh, I need to get out of here. I need a break. I need to go learn. You know, I felt like I wasn't being taught enough, you know, coming from JD squad where we were really encouraged and taught, you know, back into what was an amateur program again. And I just thought I wasn't getting the information I needed. So I pulled out the track chair, did some qualifying times, and went to a small meet in America and decided to have a holiday on top of that. And while I was there, I organized to go to basketball training camp. So I did that and told the coaches, who were mostly college coaches, that I wanted to come back and play in the US, and then sort of let my skills talk for me. And I got offers, which was really sweet. Now, 98% of them were go to college, enroll, grades, classes, and all that sort of stuff. But not being the academic that I was, or wasn't, I should say, my options were limited to the University of Kentucky, because they had a program that involved the community as well as the college, because there wasn't enough active people with a disability to form a purely college team. So they used the college name and college facilities, but you could be working in the community or living in the community and still play. So that was the one that I chose to go back to. And there started, you know, a great relationship between the coach at that time and myself, which still holds true, you know, today. You know, it's a relationship that's as solid as, and we try and catch up whenever we can. But, you know, that opened the door to me. And so I went, I think it's September 88, and did my 6 months, you know, Christmas and New Year away from family, winter, snow on the ground, you know. So it was, for 3 years, it was Australian winter, American winter, Australian winter, American winter. You probably could have started calling me Casper. I was, you know, pretty white, no sun. But that pathway that I sought, you know, to learn, paid dividends, because I made a senior A team to go to Fesbit Games in 89, and that was my first senior men's trip. And that was the beginning of my 10 years in the senior men's team. So it was the natural ability and then the coaching that got me to a level where, you know, I was able to maintain those 10 years.
And that culminated with the Atlanta Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Can we just have a big talk? I want to hear about it all. the McDonald's Olympics.
The Coca-Cola Olympics.
Yeah. And... But that was probably one of the best Australian basketball team to go away. You guys, just talk through going to that. Probably it's quite interesting. You went to that Olympics compared to the little tin sheds you did in London, in England. Stoke-on-Trent was one of your first international trips.
Look, you'd think it'd be different. You'd be wrong.
Yeah.
As lead up to that, I went to Barcelona.
That's right. In
92.
Yeah.
But also the World Championships in 90 in Belgium, and then Canada in 94. So, you know, 5-6 years into the program, or me being into the program, and we're getting, you know, between 8th and 10th is, you know, where we're finishing consistently. You know, we're not the worst in the world, but we're pretty damn close. And then we got new coaching. We had, you know, a young protege come through who just spent time at college in the US himself, along with other, you know, people that had been around a while. And so we had this nice blend of experience and youth in the team. So, you know, we got there, you know, and we move into the accommodation, and it's like, oh, okay, so two people to a room. Bunk beds. Okay. Wheelchair basketball players and bunk beds. All right. Now, again, there's a classification system, you know, from most disabled to least disabled. So least disabled got the top bunks. Most disabled got the bottom bunks. As what we'd normally do, we'd pull things apart and make it work. So, you know, the bunk beds were the split design, so you could actually take them apart. But that meant totally redesigning a room. So whenever we went, we'd always have to redesign stuff so we could actually get in and fit into a room. So once again, you know, we're pulling things apart, you know, trying to make things work. You know, day one, we're there, and it's no blankets. Welcome to your Paralympics. Have a nice day. So, you know, we're using towels and whatever, you know, that night. I think the blankets turned up the next day or the day after. And nothing you could do. It is what it is. We're in Georgia. You know, it's not freezing cold. So, you know, it's not as bad as, you know, like a European winter. But anyway, you know, hurdle one, bump one. You do that sort of stuff and you work it out. And, you know, we start training in facilities and the whole team's together. You know, we're working out what we need to do and how we need to do it. And our first game's against Spain. This guy's talking to the Spanish team in warm-ups. And we eyeball him and we work out who it is. It's Juan Antonio Samaranch, the director of the IOC, at that stage.
Mm.
Given the Spanish team a pep talk, I'm like, yeah, great, just what we need. You can go away anytime soon. And so the Spanish, they came out firing. I mean, they were lighting it up. There's a guy called De Paz, and you know, the basket must have looked like a football field, man. Everything he threw up fell in. You know, we had one of our best, if not our best defender, basically sitting on his knee, you know, putting his hands over his eyes, and he was still making these shots. You know, we were guarding him that tight, but I guess if you're in the zone, you're in the zone. You know, and we ended up dropping that game. And so we were all a bit grumpy, and you know, we had to sort of gather ourselves and refocus on what we needed to do and how we were going to do it. And that was, you know, a combination of meeting with the coaches, you know, internal team structure meeting, that sort of stuff, and all of that. But in the village, although everything was free, they didn't want you to bring food into your accommodation. So, you know, they turned off all the power points. So no fridges, microwaves, any of that in the apartment, which was like a 6-bedroom apartment at University of Georgia or Georgia Tech. Anyway, I may or may not have picked the lock into the fuse box to turn everything on again and then relocked it, allegedly. And there was a house rule that if you're going past the vending machine, then you're getting a drink for yourself, you know, grab another one or two and bring it back now that we had a working fridge. So we were doing this, playing basketball at the same time, and you know, we guys at like our starting five were just, you know, pretty beat up all the time. So my role was of a secondary role, you know, very much late in the game, come in, knock down foul shots when other people had fouled out, and you know, we're in the bonus. So I took on the role as scavenger or scrounger for these guys. Or, you know, what do we need? How do we need it? You and I were talking earlier about coffee or the lack of in America of anything that we consider decent. So that was something I went on the hunt for, and I found a drip coffee machine, filters, coffee, got that set up. I'd go away, you know, bang on the door, let me in, to the response, you've got a key, open it yourself. I'm like, hurry up and open the door. And they open the door, and I've got like two slabs of like energy drinks on my lap that I happened to have acquired from somewhere near the food block and stuff. So I was the official scrounger, and you know, we'd bring food back up for the guys that needed to sleep, needed to rest, because we dropped that first game, but we were winning our other games that we'd come up against, and we're on a roll. And you know, so I'm trying to look after the boys that were looking after us. So you know, random requests like, do we need anything? You know, when I go out looking for stuff, you know, 67 Corvette, you say, yeah, good luck with that. Anyway, that was the sort of light-hearted, you know, world championships, you know, around the kitchen table that we were doing to entertain ourselves and still be low impact and rest and recover and be able to play through this schedule as well as the training that we had. And we'd always set a goal of making the top four. That's what we wanted. So the finals come around. Spain were top and we were second because they'd beaten us. So we had this crossover game against Holland. Now, Holland had been a real pain in our side for the last couple of years, including a competition we went to prior to going on our Paralympic tour that year. And they'd spanked us. And there's no other word for it. You know, they made us look silly. Anyway, it was a super close game. It came down to, you know, the last 5 seconds. Scores, I think Holland are up by one, or tied or up by one. Our big guy, Troy, who had been playing really well, and if you've ever seen any footage of the big bald bloke going nuts, well, that's Troy, all right? He's not actually bald, he was just trying to be really aggressive and gave himself that super aggressive, I'm going to get you hairdo. That seemed to almost be a trademark after that, but the ball was delivered to him inside the key, and he made the bucket, which countered, and that put us, you know, 1 point, one point up, and a couple of seconds later the siren goes and we win. Okay, so we're super pumped. So if you can imagine a game of stacks on with wheelchairs, with Troy being at the bottom of it, which is all piling on, right? There's arms, legs, wheelchairs, wheels, everything going in every direction, and he's at the bottom. Anyway, I ferret my way down at the bottom, and because he was my roommate, so we used to spend a lot of time together. He's like, "What are you all doing?" I'm like, "Dude, you just hit the winning shot." He's like, "Really? I thought we were up. I was going to hold it." I'm like, "Oh my God, don't tell the others. They'll cry." So that gets us through to the semis. And our semi was against the Americans. And they had been promoted or promoting themselves as the dream team. So, you know, home games, family everywhere, you know, everybody, you know, cheering for them. We came out, really hard fought game. We came down to foul shots at the end of the game, and the guys did really well. And we won that one, and we achieved the goal of being top four by simply doing that. You know, there was a few single digit, two digit salutes to the crowd by people in the squad, you know, people in the team, because, you know, we knocked off the Americans, who were, you know, heavy favourites. And we did it in their backyard, and they were all on the court crying, and we loved it. Sorry to any Americans out there, but you know, you had to understand the joy that it was to see all of these egos get absolutely smashed into a thousand different directions, and the chain of tears that went up their whole family tree. It was fantastic. I know I shouldn't say it, but I have to. So now, you know, it's gold medal game for us against England. We'd already beaten them once. They came out and they were on fire. They had a low pointer, so someone with a higher end disability, and he was just knocking down these shots. You know, and normally in a game you match up, you know, similar disability to similar disability, because they're your best matchups. Because if you put someone with like what we call a low classification on someone who's got a high classification, so someone with a spinal cord injury at sort of like middle chest compared to someone who's just got a single leg amputation, the single leg amputated player should be better because they've got more muscle available to them, more muscle structure, better balance, physically more ability, right? So we had to change that up. We had to put a higher classification guy and, you know, put it on this guy to change it around, which meant the rest of the guys had to cover the gaps that would then leave. So at half time they were up 15 points. We were worried, you know, we thought we've got this far, you know, and there was a chant, a cry, a war cry, if you like, that we were using all tournament, where one of the guys would say, "What time is it?" And then the rest of us would just be yelling, you know, "Our time," and give like a "ooh" at the end of it. And so we took that into the locker room, and, you know, we looked at what we're doing and how we're doing it, you know, and certain guys, you know, these guys have got fouls and how we need to go at them, or, you know, if we've got these fouls we need to be careful, and the structure of what we're going to do. And we came out and we put them under heaps of pressure, and it was working. You know, it was literally one stop, one basket. I know it's a cliche, but that's what we did, and that was the mentality we took in. We just need to stop them once, and we just need to score one, and that's all we did. And we kept going, and we kept going, and we kept going. My roommate in the meantime is racking up a tidy sum, you know. He'd go inside and score buckets, so they'd put extra pressure on him, and that's okay. So then he'd go back out behind the three-point line and, you know, start knocking down threes. So they'd come out to him out there, so he'd just go back inside again. And he was doing that all game, and he ended up with like a world record for the amount of points scored in any Paralympic or Olympic basketball final. I want to say 42, but I'd have to check it. But so he went off the Richter scale. And with that one stop, one basket mentality, we ended up winning by 15. So within those 20 minutes, we'd had a 30-point turnaround. And, you know, I think once we got ahead and they rallied, but they couldn't come back, I think we crushed them emotionally as well as physically, and were able to get away at the end of it. And that, of course, led to, you know, more stacks on action in the middle of the court with arms and legs and wheels and wheelchairs going in every direction. The photo of you with flowers and a gold medal around your neck on the dais that you just cannot, you know, the smile that joins at the back of your head, you know, like all these lifetime goals, like ticked, you know, beyond lifetime goals, you know, you probably set them lower and you've gone beyond all that stuff and beyond all that process. Yeah, it's just the most amazing feeling ever.
I think you hoisted someone up onto the ring as well.
There might have been a couple of blokes.
There's a famous photo or video.
Swinging off the ring, cutting the net down.
Yeah.
We still want to cut the net down. It's just harder to get up there, that's all.
But you guys just hoist them up. Is that...
Depends. If they're a single leg amputee and can dunk off one leg, which Troy could at that stage, he jumped up, grabbed the ring, and ended up sitting on top of the ring. You know,
I remember watching it on TV. It was pretty cool.
You know, with the net in one hand and the number one, you know, salute finger, you know, like we are number one, going up. But I mean, he totally deserves those accolades. I mean, he was off the hook. I mean, everybody contributed. Like, this was not a tournament based around a couple of people. Mm. You know, it was all 12 of us. We all had really key roles in certain games that got us over the line. You know, we had to go really deep in our roster, you know, for that whole championship. It didn't matter if, you know, you were making foul shots at the beginning of the game, or you were hitting open layups, or you were able to recover quickly to get back in defense, or whatever it happened to be. You know, we all, as a whole unit, did it. You know, there were some exceptional performances by a variety of individuals in that. But I think you need that in any team. You know, you've got people that you support, you know, with offensive structure and defense and that sort of stuff, but they can't do what they do if you don't support them. So it really is that whole team, you know, mentality.
And what was the celebration like going back to the village with Olympic gold?
Unfortunately, I'm unable to speculate on any of those details because we were having far too much fun.
So was there poor other people that had to compete the next day and you blokes?
Yes, there was, and we didn't care.
You destroyed their Olympic dream, did you, by partying too hard? Or?
No, because we're basically one of the last events.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we might have got told off for being too noisy coming home a couple of nights because people had events the next day and stuff, which we responded to. So we took our celebrations out of the village and we, you know, lots of people had family there and, you know, we sort of did stuff and then, you know, people would go with their groups and family and celebrate, you know, as they needed to because, you know, it was the thing that we all wanted, but whether if we all saw it or not as an actual possibility or a possibility that year was amazing. So, yeah, we were the first team ever to win a gold medal for basketball out of Basketball Australia, either, you know, Paralympic or Olympic, men or women. So, God, pretty happy about that.
Set standard.
Which I'm happy to say the Australian men's team have backed up since. So, yeah, that's really good.
That team, did that stay together as a unit after that games, or did it sort of just fall apart a bit? Was that it? Was that the pinnacle for that group of people, or did you go off and do...
For that group, that was the pinnacle.
Yeah.
Because we did have such a broad spectrum of age in that, I think at the World Championships in 2 years' time, the majority of the team were there for that. Different coaching structure, and I think that's what might have let us down a bit. But we didn't achieve what we wanted to achieve at the Worlds 2 years later. Yeah, and then it was a different unit that went to Sydney. Mm-hmm. You know, still some people in there. My roommate Troy, because he was so young, He actually backed up in 08 and got a second Paralympic gold, you know, with the other Australian team that did it. So he was the only one that can proudly say, you know, he's got a nice pair of gold medals from Paralympic wheelchair basketball. And there's only a few people in the world that can say that. The Canadians would be the other ones.
So where did you go from there? Is that when you started coaching? I know you went to Italy coaching, or did you start coaching in Australia first?
I kept playing basketball.
Yeah.
I didn't make the team for 2000. Tried really hard, just didn't cut it. I was coming off the back of an injury and surgery. And at the time of selections, I wasn't in great shape. So, you know, I wasn't selected. You know, they had to choose healthy, fit people. And at that stage, I was not healthy or fit enough to play that level. I kept playing National League, you know, with Adelaide. Also played with Wollongong for a while, for three, four years. So I was still heavily involved and was dabbling with a bit of coaching, but also got involved with the classification of athletes. Now, I'm still doing that now. In 07, I started doing that and had gone through the processes where I look at the functional ability of a player and we give them a score between 1 and 4.5 because a coach needs to have a total number of 14 points or less in the five players that are on the court. And the reason it's those numbers is so that we've got a blend of people with a high level of disability, a medium level of disability, and a low level of disability all on the court at the same time, right? So that, you know, we're not excluding anybody from the game, all right? So it's next level inclusion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Paralympic Games are all about inclusion, and if we were to exclude people based on their disability, then that's really crazy. That's just... Well, I'd be really silly to do it. So, you know, so I got involved from the classification. And in 2010, I went to England for my exam at the World Championships. And from there, I've been an international classifier since 2010. So 7 years now. So that lets me go, you know, I get to see pretty much all of the Australian people over the course of a year. And then the occasional overseas trip to tournaments. Under 23 men, under 25 women, open men, open women, qualifiers, that sort of things. So it still keeps me involved with the game. I don't have to go to all the trainings. I don't have to come up with strategy. You know, I've got a book as a reference, very clear guidelines as to what's what. And I enjoy doing that. I don't enjoy that, you know, 12-hour days in cold gyms in the middle of an Australian winter, but that's okay. There are benefits.
And has there been a coaching role as well? Have you taken on...
Yeah, I've been an assistant coach in Adelaide for a lot of years, and I had a three-month opportunity to go to Sardinia in Italy and coach the club team in Porto Torres. So that was really interesting.
How did the language work? Is your Italian pretty good?
My Italian is poor, but because it was a professional league, okay, so I had... Italians. I had a gentleman from Poland, Lithuania, South Africa, Japan, England, South Africa. So that was my roster of languages. Mm-hmm. So everything had to be diagrammed and then translated with all those languages. So it was a little crazy. I've got a Japanese friend or a Japanese guy that played for me, and we will speak to each other in Italian because his English is not that good and my Japanese is not that good. So, you know, Italian's our common language, you know, because we're both average at Italian. So that's where we go. So it's really different, unique, you know, 3 months, you know, really good learning for me. Not a whole lot of success, but it was a turbulent time for that team. Great experience. Wouldn't have traded it.
Incredible. Yeah, no, you remember you're going away.
Yeah, but we're talking about Sardinia in winter, man. It's not like, you know, the summer season with, you know, all the million-dollar yachts cruising past and all that sort of stuff.
No, I think I'll have you down the beach, some bacon.
people rubbing oil on you?
Yeah, no. It was thermals and big coats and beanies and all of that stuff. So, but it was fun. I enjoyed it.
You also did a stint working in schools and working advertiser award nights. I know my daughter was. You presented my daughter with an award.
Youth Sports
once.
Awards.
You've I was done a lot involved of work with them for that.
Yeah, I volunteer my time. That's what I have to give.
Hmm.
I'm not in a corporate structure where I have money to donate to an organisation, but I've got time. So there's a few things that I'm really passionate about. One is a remote Indigenous health program called Red Dust Role Models, where we, since 2002, have been going out to remote communities in the Territory. And when we go, say, remote, I mean, we're losing AM radio when we're driving out there. You know, so let's go to a desert, go through a desert, out the other side, oh, look, there's a community out by the WA border. That's where we're going to be. So that's the most rewarding program I reckon I've ever done. Volunteered my time in. Just amazing. And they use four types of role models. Athletes, musicians, dancers, and artists, right? Because they seem to be the four things that connect the most with the kids in the communities and the schools that we go to. I also volunteered and did programs taking wheelchair basketball into schools, which is the Wheelie Net program that you were talking about just before. But yeah, I've got time to give, but I don't have, you know, the financial backing to give a program, so that's taught me, and hopefully I've been able to teach others.
And the latest thing you're involved in, can you explain your it's sort of a using water.
It's a therapy program.
For therapy.
It's a therapy program.
I mean, a lot of us in the track and field world would have done water-based training. I'm a big believer in that, and so is Chris Nunn that sort of set up the stuff that the AIS were using. But you've taken it to another level in some ways. Do you just want to talk about what's happening with that?
I'm involved and have been involved for nearly 2 years now with a program called Immersion Therapy. We have people who are injured, either motor vehicle accidents, workplace, disability in general. What we do is we get them into a couple of meters of water, literally 2 meters, a meter and a half, 2 meters, and we give them as much air as they want through like scuba tank floating on the surface, or you know, depending where they are in their learning and their disability, or wearing the scuba gear underwater. We don't offer any pathways to the ocean. This is purely a controlled water environment, you know, that, you know, we've got edges and we've got people and we've got really good ratios, you know, 1-to-1, 1-to-2, all the time. And it's, you know, with emphasis on safety. So we've got people who might have a minor disability, through to someone who has high level quadriplegia or cerebral palsy, or so many people with so many different disabilities are coming through. So we give them water. So we take away gravity, right? Once we put them in the water, we take away the gravity. Small muscle groups that are not going to work in gravity, because an arm and a leg is going to weigh a certain amount, and those muscle groups are not strong enough to move them, have the ability to be moved in water. So if we keep working on that, and water, using the water mass as resistance training, people are becoming better. Like for myself, the benefits I get out of it are my posture, relief on my back. And then there's the social benefits. You know, just like training in the squad back in the day, you know, we've got like-minded people who have a shared experience of being in the water, whether they're instructors or assistants or clients, you know, and we all come up and talk about it, and you know, we're getting these most amazing reactions from people. I mean, again, smiles that just join at the back of the head, And you know, people that are coming out with the this is the most amazing thing that's I've ever done. You know, these people are ticking off things on their bucket list that they never thought they'd be able to do. And it's all thanks to a guy called Peter Wilson, who used diving in the ocean as part of his own therapy after he had an accident. So you know, we've now just taken it to that next level, you know, and we've got people with some pretty severe disabilities being able to, you know, have that freedom of movement. I mean, water is freedom. You know, we give them lots of air. I mean, what's the one pain in the butt when you go swimming? Is having to keep stick your head up to get air, right? imagine if you could just be in the water and just be. Stand on your head if you want to stand on your head. Float upside down, blow bubbles, doesn't matter. Every movement you make while you're in the water is exercising you.
So you don't? Do you have set programs you try to introduce as well? Is it individualized where you try
it's
to
very,
create?
It's very individualized, yeah. Because every person has a different disability, yeah. Even though they'll get like a blanket coverage, like this is cerebral palsy. Well, okay. Yes, you have cerebral palsy, but how long's a piece of string? There's so many variations in that. So it's all about getting them involved, working out what they want to do, what they can do, how can we make that work for that person. Really, the only thing that puts the brakes on us is if they don't pass our modified medical. So we've got a modified medical, you know, and we're talking about ears and lungs primarily. You know, if there are issues, like if you've had collapsed lungs or you've got inner ear balance problems, all that sort of stuff, which is normal water traits, but you know, we have to stick by them because you know they're key rules that we can't break. But it is a very modified medical, you know, so you know, we're 2 years old and we're growing, which is really exciting. We're just, you know, starting up in Port Lincoln as well. So North Adelaide Aquatic Centre in Port Lincoln, you know, Determined 2 is the name of the company, and immersion therapy is what we do.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's a beautiful thing. And I'm a big believer in water-based training. Yeah. I think it's, and you've just taken it to another level, to another group of people, and opened up another world for people.
Well, a lot of people we're getting at the moment are people who've never had access to what I had access to. I had my disability allowed me to go and participate in games and fun, you know, from a very young age. Or if you've got someone at a very high end of disability who needs a carer all the time, and that sort of stuff, well, we're getting these people with this high end disability and these high needs into the water and giving them that freedom of movement. So we're taking them from a two-dimensional world, which is just getting around, maybe in their wheelchair, maybe walking around, whatever their disability happens to be. We're getting them into the water and hoping that, and that then opens it up to a three-dimensional world, because they can go wherever the water is, the same as anybody else that's in the water, except we're giving them lots of air and they can be in there for 3/4 of an hour if they want, as long as they're not chewing through, you know, a tank. If they chew through a tank, they're going to have to come up, we're going to have to give them more air. And we've got people who do that. They're having so much fun that they're just breathing, and they're just like, oh my gosh, they smashed that tank. Okay, another tank, bring it in, load them up, get them back in, going again.
We'll just finish off with one last question.
Sure.
Is what makes you happy?
Ooh, what makes me happy? Other people's smiles. You know, if I can teach someone something, and I'm sure teachers will say it all the time, you know, like the satisfaction they get is, you know, the smiles from a student where they know that what they've taught has been absorbed and is being used, and they see the joy of the shared knowledge. That I really enjoy doing, you know, and that's one of the reasons I do volunteer in the bits and pieces that I volunteer in, you know, the passion for Red Dust Role Models, the passion for immersion therapy, you know, being able to teach these skills and be in the water with people and seeing them, you know, come to the surface, you know, absolutely elated because they've done something they might have never been able to do before we're able to teach them the skills, you know, whatever that happens to be, wherever we happen So, yeah, that's pretty important. And just keeping myself happy. Yeah. If I can make other people happy and keep myself happy, that's fine by me.
That's fantastic. And
just keep cruising on.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Mate, you are very welcome.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and forward this podcast on to your friends. Last week, we had over 1,000 listeners.